Welcome to another program of Savoir Faire, the program about design and designers, which is being brought to you by the History of Art Department under the coordination of Dr. Giuseppe Scambri Bonacci, who is also the Artistic Director of the Indina Biennale 2015. I am Melanie Farrugia and I will be your hostess during these programs. I remind you that the program comes with a website where you can view images of what is being mentioned during the program. The website is melfarrugia.wix.com/savoirfaire. Also, I urge you to like us on Facebook by searching Savoir Faire and also to like the Campus FM Facebook page, which you can find under Campus FM 103.7. Francesca Balzan is an art historian and also the curator of Palazzo Falson, which is a historic museum house in Medina. And she was also the curator of the large-scale exhibition about jewelry that we had in Malta a couple of years ago. The exhibition was called Vanity, Profanity and Worship, Jewelry from the Maltese Islands, and was organized by Fondazione Patrimonio, which was held in the lovely venue of the Casino Maltese. I remind you that for more information about this exhibition, you can get the magnificent catalogue with images of all the exhibits along with a number of essays about various topics related to jewelry. Also, one can get the DVD of this exhibition, which provides 360 degrees walkthroughs and detailed images and information about the pieces which were exhibited. Francesca also published the book called Jewelry in Malta, Treasures from the Island of the Knights. We will be discovering why these pieces are outstanding and so precious, if it is because of the cost of the materials used or perhaps the context in which and for which they were made or for who they were made, and the story behind them. So Francesca, we can start with the first interesting piece.
Yes, an interesting piece, not of great value, but for me absolutely fascinating because of the story it tells. This is an operculum ring. We happen to have one in the Palazzo Falson collection, so it's extremely helpful because I am able to see what it looks like. We know about this operculum ring because even people like Guido Lanfranco had worked on it and had mentioned it in his writings. Basically, the operculum ring, what is an operculum? The operculum is the lid of a seashell, the cover of a seashell. Generally, they used to use the covers of the Astrea rugosa, it's a particular type of seashell. This looks a bit like an eye, like a human eye. And according to the doctrine of signatures, which is something which is of widespread belief in folk medicine, this doctrine of signatures is that if an object from nature looks like a body part, then it can cure that body part. It's like God has pointed out to us what can cure you easily by illustrating it in nature. So this object obviously led people in the past to believe that it could cure eye disease, and there was a particular eye disease that is connected with it, and this is pterygium. Now, the ring, the operculum ring, is basically mounted with the operculum. It's mounted in a solid silver mount, and at the back, there is an engraving, a very basic engraving, like an octopus. And the reason, the connection is that an octopus, in Maltese, Arnita, refers to the same eye condition. So, together, within this ring, you are first of all indicating that it's going to be used to cure your eye because the operculum looks like an eye, and secondly, this is emphasized by the engraving of the octopus at the back. Now, what used to happen? Basically, they would pass the ring over the eye, and this ring, incidentally, was known as Il Hatem Tal Arnita. Il Hatem is an old term for ring, and Arnita, as we've seen, is an octopus. This would be passed over the eye and an incantation would be said. Now, the incantation was like a magic incantation, and yet it referred to particular saints. So it's interesting, once again, you're mixing up superstition with religion. Mm-hmm. It's all mixed up. You're just trying to protect yourself in some manner or to cure yourself. Also very, very interesting, Olvin Vella, who is, of course, with the Department of Maltese and has conducted a number of studies in various archives, had come across an incantation in the Inquisition archives, and it dates to the late 18th century, 1788 or so. And again, it mentions eye disease and it mentions saints who can help to cure this eye disease. So I find this extremely interesting, and we're lucky to actually have one of these surviving rings in a collection where it can be seen.
Yeah, sometimes I have this curiosity of how it started, that a certain object or amulet started being used against this disease. I mean, somehow, I guess, maybe by a coincidence, someone was wearing something when he had this disease and got cured. In some way, it must have started.
I suppose we can never really answer that question, because this is lost in the mists of time. It would not be something that would be recorded at the time, because, again, this is folk medicine. So many times, it would be passed down by word of mouth. You can't really know for a fact when it would have started. And like you say, it must have happened by coincidence, and even because of this doctrine of signatures, this belief in the past that a like cures like, you know. An object that looks like a body part can cure you. This has been written about at length even in 17th century and later, but again, we can't know for a fact when it started.
We can move on to our next particular piece.
A very contrasting piece, very, very different, purely religious, very beautiful and of high intrinsic value. Let's look at the Trivulzio Cross, so-called Trivulzio Cross. This is a name I gave it myself, subsequent to research I made about it. This is basically, just to give a kind of a basic description, is a rock crystal cross, about 16 centimeters long. So rock crystal, quite thick, transparent. It looks like glass, if you like. And in it are a number of medallions, 14, 7 on the front, 7 on the back. And they're inserted into the rock crystal. And in each medallion is covered by a sort of a raised glass, a slightly domed glass cover. And underneath it, you can see that there is a tiny painting. Each medallion is around the size of my thumbnail. And you can barely make out the painting, but the painting under a microscope, you can make out each painting of each medallion represents a different station of the way of the cross. And it's actually, it must have been painted in a very églomisé technique, which is basically painting on glass from the back. So quite a complicated technique. And it's also included in the colors are gold, it's painted with gold. So quite a revelation. I looked at it and it looked beautiful, but when I looked closer, all of a sudden I discovered there were the stations of the cross, which makes it even more relevant. Well, this particular piece, this precious, beautiful cross, is found in the collection of the Imdina Cathedral. It has a particular history. I had seen it and I examined it, and of course I saw the gold terminals at the end. It's embellished with enamel. Enamel is basically like a paint made out of crushed glass and bound together, and then it's fired, so it becomes a very hard, glossy substance. I didn't know how it had ended up in the cathedral's collection, but that's where the archives helped me. I examined the various inventories of the cathedral, of the Imdina Cathedral, and it emerges that this cross, it's recorded that this cross was given by Bishop Balaguer in 1648. It was given to the cathedral for the use of future bishops.
So where did Bishop Balaguer get it from?
Well, we have a solution to that as well, because one of the inventories actually mentions that it was a gift to Balaguer from Cardinal Trivulzio. Cardinal Trivulzio visited Malta in 1649, a year after the bishop had given the cross to the church, so he must have met him at some earlier date and it was given to him. Cardinal Trivulzio was a viceroy in Sicily at the time, so he was a very, very important figure. So these are fascinating insights into the past. This is a rare survival as well. It's a cross which can only be earlier than 1648, of course.
And what about attribution, or where did it come from?
difficult to say where it was originally made, but my theory is that it was possibly made in Sicily. Sicily, they had their techniques of working in gold, and their creation of jewelry was magnificent. They're very, very close to the Spanish context as well, for obvious historic reasons. In fact, it is sometimes very hard to tell Spanish jewelry apart from Sicilian jewelry. They share so many similar stylistic traits. Again, interesting because it is a quality piece. It's really one of the outstanding pieces of jewelry that survive in Malta. And with a provenance, we know who gave it to the church, we know from whom he got it. So at least we've tried to push back the provenance a bit. Whether we can in future find out where Trifulcio may have acquired it from, but bearing in mind he was viceroy in Sicily, it makes a lot of sense that he would have acquired it there. Again, it's scope for future research.
So, just to clarify a bit, when Trivulzio gave this piece to Balaguer, he gave it as a personal gift to him, not aimed to be then given to Malta.
He must have, but we don't really know for a fact. This is the problem. In fact, it's only from the inventories that we know this cross that Bishop Balaguer gives to the cathedral had originally been a gift to him from Cardinal Trivulzio. And the reason we know that is because there's a little note in one of the inventories. That is how I found out. And it's lucky that whoever it was who bothered to put down this note for a jewelry historian who'd be researching so many centuries later. But we don't know exactly the context of the gift giving of this cross to Balaguer. We don't know.
So we can move on to another curiosity.
Yes. Again, a very contrasting piece, or pieces, I should say. Let's look at the Tadubena Parur. First of all, what's a parur? A parur is a set of jewelry intended to be worn together. In this case, it's probably more of a demi-parur because it consists of a bracelet, a brooch, and a pair of earrings. Why is it Tadubena? Tadubena, of course, means of the fly in Maltese, the fly as in the insect. Now, what does it look like? Well, this was a very popular type of jewelry in the 19th century, and it is made basically the central focus of each of the pieces, so the bracelet, the brooch and the earrings, is a micro-mosaic panel, an oval micro-mosaic panel, and at the center is a very large, actually it's a scarab, it's not a fly, but for some reason the Maltese must have just, there might not have been a word for scarab, although as far as I know it's scarabeo. But they decided it was a fly, Tadubena, and it's green, so perhaps they were thinking of a dying fly. At any rate, this type of jewelry gets known as the Tadubena jewelry. And what I find fascinating about it is, because it's not a purely Maltese piece of jewelry, it is an Italo-Maltese piece of jewelry. Why is that? This micro-mosaic panel, which is the central feature of each of the pieces of jewellery, is done in an Egyptian revival style, very, very popular towards the end of the 19th century. But micro-mosaic was a specialty of Rome. This was done for many, many decades in Rome. Basically, micro-mosaic is what it means. Mosaic in tiny, tiny glass tessere, little, little glass pieces, making up a mosaic of a design. In this case, the design is that of a scarab or a fly. It's interesting because we were importing these micro-mosaic panels and then mounting them in gold worked in Malta. So the central part of the jewellery is Italian, Roman actually, from Rome. But and then it was mounted in gold and very beautifully done actually. The mount is very beautifully done and it's decorated with these classical motifs of vines and scrolling tendrils, which reminds us of the archaeological taste which was prevalent at the time. And another interesting thing is that when you look at the marks on the piece of gold jewelry, we don't know who did the micromosaic because there's no indication of that, but the indication on the gold pieces of the jewelry on the mount itself is that they were made by Francesco Melli. Now, Francesco Melli was one of the most important jewelers active in Malta in the late 19th century. He he acquired his license to work as a jeweler in the mid-19th century, and for decades afterwards, his jewelry practice grew and grew and grew. He was by far the jeweler who was advertising the most. I kept finding adverts of his repeatedly in newspapers of the time. He seems to have been taken up by, he was patronized by, of course, the British administration at the time. And he became particularly well known, and he was particularly lauded, and he actually received a prize for a silver boat that he created. Now, this was not a piece of jewelry, but an objet d'art, a larger piece. So even the maker of this piece of jewelry is interesting. So back to the Taddubena Parur, once again we have a piece of jewelry, or pieces of jewelry, because it's made up of a bracelet, a brooch, and a pair of earrings, which are mounted micro-mosaic panels brought over from Rome, imported in the 19th century to Malta, and then mounted in gold that was wrought in Malta by such a sort of famous, at least on the Maltese context, such a famous jeweler. So I think this brings together very, very nicely our more recent history in terms of jewelry.
And if I'm not mistaken, this particular set was also in the exhibition.
Yes, it was, absolutely, because it's so typical. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you speak to your grandmother, she might recall the Taddubena jewelry. I've come across people who remember them. They remember their own grandmothers wearing them, or they remember them passing down through the family. And at the stage, you know, people are not really wearing these old pieces of jewelry, but somehow, because it's, you know, it has intrinsic value, it's gold, you keep it as a family heirloom, but not necessarily wear it.
Yeah, and I mean, the micro mosaic, it's such a piece of art. It's incredible.
When of course it is.
You have the opportunity to look really how it's made. It's incredible.
In fact, we had a whole section in the exhibition dedicated to micro mosaic, and people were surprised, because we would make them look at the object and say, do you know what you're looking at? Do you realize that that is a piece of mosaic? But they're so small, the tessera making it up are so small, that it's hard to make out that it's not a solid piece.
So we can move on to our fourth special guest jewelry today.
The next piece takes us to the island of Gozo. This is a very, very special piece. It is the necklace of Saint Ursula, known as the necklace of Saint Ursula. This is used, or used to be used, to adorn the reliquary bust of Saint Ursula, which is at Matrice, the cathedral in Gozo. Now, this necklace is a composite piece. It's made up of a series of medallions, painted medallions on the glass, and then each medallion is adorned with different colored jewels. I'm dating it to the 18th century, but it has a pendant hanging from it with enameling at the back, which I'm dating to the 17th century, and the clasp, which is 19th century, and I'll explain to you. First of all, do we know where it came from? No. And I've looked through the archives, and I haven't as yet found a definitive reference to where it came from. However, it's popularly held that it was given, along with the bust reliquary, to the church, to the Matrice at the time, by Fray Eugenio Ramirez Maldonado, who was governor of Gozo, and it was given in 1614. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I'm dating it to a later period than that, so I don't think this is necessarily the case, but there is this popular lore. And a lot of stories attached to this particular necklace, which I find fascinating, because it's a piece of jewelry which encompasses so much more than just its intrinsic value. It's held that this necklace was stolen twice and twice recovered. The first time, it was found in the pocket of a man who had hanged himself. They actually found it in the corpse's pocket, basically. The second time, it got stolen, and it was found around 1920 in a jeweler's shop, where they were trying to sell it off. But it was recovered, and it's back at the cathedral, and it's nice and safe there. Now, why is it so special? Saint Ursula is very special to the cathedral in Gozo. Saint Ursula, first of all, she was declared patron saint of Gozo in the 1620s. And the Godsons have always had recourse to her whenever they had some calamity. She is credited with alleviating the plague from Gozo and with halting other calamities, like there's recorded that there was a plague of locusts, earthquakes. Whenever there were these problems, they looked to Saint Ursula for divine intercession. She's also held to have been placed in the Guardiola at the Cittadella of Gozo, looking towards Shara in the beginning of the 19th century when there was the last plague outbreak. And it was localized just to Shara. In fact, there was a cordon sanitaire made around Shara to prevent it spreading beyond. And so that the people of Shara, who were desperate at the time, they were trapped in Shara with the plague raging around them, could pray. They wanted to pray to Saint Ursula, so they made her bust available. They raised her in the Guardiola, looking towards Shara, where they would have seen her from a distance and praying to her, and they would pray to her. Why is this so important? Why is the plague episode so important? Well, the clasp at the end of this necklace is made of a very different sort of gold than the rest of the necklaces. It's a different color. When you turn it over, there's written at the back, there's written some initials, which I take to be a dedication. And then, il primo aprile 1814, and that was the time when the plague was raging in Shara at the time. So it's very likely that it was connected with either somebody feeling that he had some divine deliverance or whatever from being attacked by the plague. There might be some connection. Of course, I have absolutely no proof, but the date is relevant. So again, a composite piece, but also very, very important because of the stories it holds and because of the importance with its connection with Saint Ursula.
So in 1814, only the clasp was added on.
We certainly know that it was that the necklace as it appears nowadays, which is a tight choker made of these medallions with the pendant, which is earlier, 17th mm-hmm. century, as I mentioned, and the clasp, it certainly was already placed together in that manner by 1926, because we have an old photograph which was published in 1926 showing the reliquary bust of Saint Ursula wearing this precise, exact necklace.
So, the last...
The last, one of my favorite pieces.
I know what's going to end. I know, it's one of your favorites.
The Passalacqua chain. This was a lucky break for me. I have very personal recollections of it. This is actually a very, very beautiful piece of jewelry. It is a long necklace made of gold, decorated with various colors of enamel. It's absolutely beautiful, made of open work, so you can see in between each curlicue. Each medallion has curlicues, and on it are so these curls, and on it are different colors of enamel, and then it's mounted with diamonds, rubies, and pearls. So a very precious, very beautiful piece, which I have dated to the 17th century. Well, certainly before 1683, and I'll tell you why. Apart from its beauty, when I was shown this piece of jewellery, my jaw dropped, literally. I wasn't expecting it. This belongs to the collection of the Carmelite Church in Valletta. It's held in a very secure location, I'm happy to say. And I also have to commend the different caretakers, if you like, different people who have taken care of these wonderful objects, including this necklace, because it survives in a very, very good condition. And this is not easy with enamel. Enamel breaks very easily if it's dropped even a bit. So they've done a wonderful job in conserving it as it should be. This chain, incidentally, is about a meter long, so really quite a relevant piece. Why am I so excited about it, apart from its beauty? I'm excited about it because I actually managed to find who gave it to the Carmelite Church. When I was shown this piece, the first question I had was, how did it end up in this particular collection? Provenance is, of course, so important for an art historian. And it wasn't known at the time. They had no idea how. They always remembered it in the collection of the Carmelite Church, but other than that, there was no indication of how it had arrived in the church. So I asked to see their archives, and this was problematic because the person in charge of the archives was unwell at the time, then he had to have an operation. So for months on end, I was asking, could I have a look at your archives? And finally, they very kindly allowed me to do so. And as I was going through the archives, I came across an excerpt from a will dated 1683. And luckily, the notary as well was indicated, the notary who had drawn up this will. I hot-footed it to the notarial archives. The volume survives, and in it I was able to find this will. It is the will of Cesare Passalacqua, who was the first rector of the confraternity of the Virgin of Mount Carmel. This confraternity is based at the Carmelite Church. In his will, he leaves this chain and a pair of bracelets, which don't survive, to the church, and with very, very specific conditions. He says that the chain could not be alienated in any manner, so not given away, couldn't be melted down, couldn't be sold, and it was to be placed on the statue of the Virgin on her feast day, and on other giorni solenni, so other feasts. So it was actually given to the Veneranda Confraternita di Nostra Signora del Carmine. It's interesting because it even survived the French period. We know that during the French period, the jewels and the treasures of the Carmelite Church were hidden in a grave. I actually found a petition by the person who hid them in the grave asking for a pension. This emerges from the archives again, the importance of the archives to reveal the history of these wonderful objects.
Francesca, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing these amazing stories about these outstanding pieces of jewelry. I remind you that Francesca will be with us again next week, where we will be discussing contemporary jewelry, where amongst others we will be mentioning Andrew Grima and his daughter Francesca Grima. I hope you enjoyed the program today, and I urge you to join us next week. This program was brought to you by the History of Art Department under the coordination of Dr. Giuseppe Scambri Bonacci, who is also the Artistic Director of the Mdina Biennale 2015. For more information about the Biennale, you can visit mdinabiennale.org and also join the Facebook page, which you can find at the Mdina Cathedral Contemporary Art Biennale 2015. For those of you who wish to either listen again to the programs, or if you missed the program, you can find them on the following website, MaltaUniversityBroadcasting.com, under the webcasts tab, and you can choose Savoir Faire. I am Melanie Farrugia, and I hope you join us next week for another program of Savoir Faire.